that every premier will come and change the rules, and that it's not positive for a number of reasons. The second thing is that in Quebec we funded social housing for a longer time. When we look at the sort of the national picture and the federal government withdrawing from the direct funding and financing of social housing in the 1990s, we see that Quebec continued to do it, but that that has been slowly dropping, and recently there has been some quite problematic changes in the way we fund that, and bring more private sector, and starting also to adopt the language of affordable housing instead of talking about logement social. Like that also kind of there's been losses there in recent times. But in the third thing, and the one the book talks about the most, is the strong militant culture and strong organizational culture that the movement has in Quebec, and that's quite inspiring. There's a lot of groups in other provinces that is to look at the both of the Frappu and La Haclac, and with a little bit of jealousy, and it's like, if you could just only have that in Ontario or in BC, and we talk about those examples, and it's just not just not. Not only obviously the two umbrella groups, but all of that that sustains it on the ground, right? Without the local groups that really feed into higher level organizations.
Let's talk about Carney's governments. What we're seeing right now at the federal level in terms of the, I would call it legacy media hype. There's a sort of maybe you could call it the honeymoon period, but basically the media and the sort of political class and the pundit class are promoting some of the over the top claims, I think, that are being made by Carney's government, going back to the elections, but continuing now. And you see, for instance, the claim that they're going to build 500,000 new units per year, a perfect example of the obsession with supply that I was talking about. Secondly, that this is going to require a quote, wartime efforts, unquote, mobilizing every sector of society, mobilizing every order of government, and so on. And then, thirdly and finally, we need a new federal agency. The CMHC is not up to the job. We need something called Build Canada Homes to achieve our objective. So, is this a pipe dream? What do you like in this plan? What do you dislike?
Obviously, like one of the things that was interesting since the beginning of these promises was we're never really specify how much of those 500,000 are going to be social housing. Like at any point, we know exactly what we are going to build and what we're going to finance and how we're going to finance them. That's the main question, I guess, is even we, why we are we would put a lot of money to build a new corporation to build houses. What's the point? Like, why do we don't give this mandate for an organization that already exists since ages and have built before housing? We've seen it when the federal government was investing that we were having the capacity to invest and develop a lot of social housing for years, like a lot of like low income housing or just from the government, the federal government from the time. So building a new agency, that would be an interesting question of like how they're going to structure it, and also, it will be interesting to see how we are going to involve the private sector into the development of those housing, the prices, what will be the criteria of affordability, because until now, none of the criteria of affordability of the federal government is actually affordable for low income or modest income tenants are struggling already. So for us, the main question is how much of those are going to be social housing? How much of those are going to be really focused on nonprofit co-ops housing that will be really affordable for people? Because if we see the program of co-op housing right now is not affordable for low-income housing tenants to, it's not affordable. Like in Quebec, it doesn't even allow subsidies because the rents are too high. So if the criteria of affordability are not revised, we're going to still build something that are just going to continue under, strike and pushing the prices up. So we're not going to solve the prices. It's like the logic you're saying. We're building for building, right? The plan is not necessarily bad by itself, but there is many questions that hasn't been answered and how we're going to really build those ones and for who we're going to build those ones.
Thanks, Catherine. Cardo, Build
Yes,
Canada Homes. What is it? What's it gonna do?
I agree with a lot of Catherine said. And the way I think about this is the focus, what is the new federal government focusing on and what's not focusing on? And on what it's focusing on, there's the question of the how, right? So we know that the focus is not social housing. We know the focus is not tenant rights. We know that during the election, all parties, but including the party that won, failed to take a clear stance on the rights of people living in encampments and other temporary shelter. So we know that the focus is supply. Okay. So that said, now let's look at the supply, the how of supply. With Build Canada Homes, the whole language and messaging is that the government is going to get more directly engaged in the building of houses. So that is a sort of a mea culpa, a sort of acknowledgement that the National Housing Strategy in place since 2017 provided all of these incentives to private developers to build more housing and, required it. Some of those houses to be rented at a discounted price. That didn't create enough affordability. That didn't create enough supply. So now the government's going to get more directly involved, and hence the analogies with the war times and whatnot. And we're going to use this Build Canada Homes as the vehicle to get more directly involved. But to Catherine's point, we lack a lot of details there, right? Because there's two very different ways of doing this. One is where the federal government actually owns the entire process. So it's the federal government acting as a developer. So we will, do everything related to land and the licensing and everything that and financing and everything that happens before construction. For the construction piece, we would likely hire private sector, hire building construction companies, and that's fine. Those are the construction companies that actually create jobs and pay taxes and creates positive economic activity. As long as there's a transparent procurement process, we're all good. But then at the end, the government needs to own it, right? And also see to the latter part of it, which is the renting or selling or leasing and so on and so forth. That would be how we do it if it's publicly led. Unfortunately, that's not what I'm expecting, because Mark Carney is a banker, and in that tradition, and in through his messaging that the role of the government is to catalyze the private sector, what you would expect is much more of a public-private partnership, the notorious P3s, where instead of owning the entire process, the government gets in this kind of murky agreements with the private sectors, and there's all these different rules, and the private sector owns and can run it unless there is any losses, and then the government has to jump in. P3s are usually a way of making sure that government takes the risk and the private sector walks away with the profit, right? That's the gist of those deals. And unfortunately, based on the language that I'm hearing, based on Mark Carney's background, I'm assuming that Build Canada Homes is going to be a lot more about P3s than actually public-led development.
Thank you. I'd add that, not only was Mark Carney a banker, the biggest banker, but he was also the CEO of Brookfield Management, which was involved in housing speculation. So he's a housing speculator as well as a banker. So finally, this is going to be really easy. We've got 5 minutes. We're going to wrap it up with how do we ensure greater democracy, accountability, transparency in the housing policies that we get from the political class in Canada? Catherine, do you want to take a stab at that one?
I think through mobilization, like we need to have like keep mobilization for keeping accountability off like governments. I mean, they're not going to give us transparency on a plate like this if we don't reclaim it. So I think we need a public civil society that is strong and has this capacity of like asking through the government this accountability, this transparency. And that's something that we have to continue building on. There is a lot of groups that are, involved in that, or actually, all over Canada, truly getting and pushing towards this. But I think it's really by mobilization that we can arrive to force this transparency and accountability and pushing the policy towards what we want also.
Great. That's exactly what I would expect from Pafu. And Ricardo, this is like the $1 million question slash Gordian knot slash whatever you want to call it. It is the biggest problem, I think, the root cause of so much, not just in housing, but especially in housing.
I would try to simply complement what Catherine already said. We need to repoliticize the housing question, stop treating it some sort of technical
That's
puzzle, and
absolutely
really understand that this is a political question. We
right.
already have all the solutions we need. We just do not have the political power, the influence to see that any of these are implemented. And the way to acquire that power and to gain influence is to build a stronger movement, to Catherine's point. But then what I would add is that there is a large segment of Canadian civil society that wastes an enormous amount of resources, of time and energy on the sort of policy merry-go-round and on the official consultations and the lobbying on the Hill and all of those things that we have seen time and again are not delivering any results. So we need to talk as a movement, as a civil society, about strategic ways to rechannel a lot of the time, energy, and resource to building a political movement instead. And I'm talking about what labor is doing. I thought a lot about civil society organizations like they're not one that I work for, a lot of service providers, a lot of other, small community groups that get sucked into weeks or weeks or weeks of preparing a submission to a government that is will clearly not give a damn to what you have to say. And why do you spend your time in that way?
Thank you to both my guests, Ricardo and Catherine, for coming on this show today. We also need to thank Andre Goulet again, our producer at Housing Party Podcast. As well as Harbinger Media for putting this together and distributing us. Check out their amazing variety of leftist-friendly content. Finally, if you like this show's theme song by the brilliant Montreal musician Paul Carnello, please check out his new album, Combat Blues, out now on all your favorite music platforms. Goodbye, and until next time.
That was Housing Party with Dr. David Debaillet. You listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. And finally, the award-winning Abortion, a podcast about abortion in Canada's second season, continues in 2025, exploring what choice really looks like and why it's different for different people, with host Rachel Cairns in Toronto. Like on this episode with the Women's National Housing and Homelessness Network, the National Right to Housing Network, and the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, exploring the gendered impacts of the housing affordability crisis and how it impacts reproductive decisions. Now, here's Rachel.
Hey. This is Rachel, and you're listening to Abortsh, a podcast about abortion in Canada. And today, we're talking about housing and how something so fundamentally important to our quality of life has become so expensive that people are having to make real big life choices and compromises about whether to have kids.
Well, that's, one of my first thoughts was, where the hell are we even going to put a crib?
So yeah, I have a lot to say about affordable housing. It's basically impossible to find. And if you do find it, it is literally the worst place to live or very close to it.
Well, I'm 35 years old and I have two roommates. I'm lucky to be in a situation now that with two people that I really adore. But if it were up to me, I would have my own home. You know, I'd be building a home with a partner rather than with friends.
There's like a meme going around that's like, everybody eats before you get seconds, except do it for housing.
What do abortion and housing have in common? Well, they are both recognized as human rights by multiple international institutions and conventions. However, you wouldn't necessarily know it from living in Canada. Housing has a special place in my heart because it's been the biggest factor in my reproductive decisions. When I realized I was pregnant, one of the reasons I knew immediately that I wanted an abortion was because, well, I had no idea where I would live with a baby. And today, my partner and I feel much more ready to become parents, but we're still looking for a two-bedroom apartment in Toronto that's within our budget. The first time I brought up looking for a new apartment, I suggested that we try to find a two-bedroom with a rent of about $2,500 a month, admittedly a rare if not extinct find in Toronto. But that feels like the upper limit of our budget. It's $600 more than what we currently pay, $300 apiece. My boyfriend's response was to ask if I could afford the extra $300 a month. Externally, I just said that I could. Internally, I started to panic. Sure, I can manage the extra $300 now, but as a self-employed person, I'm not eligible for parental leave. I would love to get the same kind of mat leave that people with full-time jobs get to have, that is 12 months off work at 55% of my salary. And that's assuming I'll be able to work right up until it's time to deliver. What if something happens and I can't? I wanted to shout at him, "Can you afford it?" And then a trauma response kicked in, and I began questioning every choice I'd ever made, including being in this relationship, and started thinking about exit strategies. The biggest question inherent in all of them was, where would I live? In 2021, the Women's National Housing and Homelessness Network conducted the largest national survey focused on gender-specific housing challenges in Canada. The study gathered insights from women, girls, and gender-diverse individuals who had experienced housing instability or homelessness within the past 3 years.
There were a lot of really interesting findings, but one of the most important findings, I think, is we asked this question, how did you lose your most recent housing? Because most folks who are experiencing homelessness, they were housed at some point. They went through a dehousing process, so it's really important to understand what that trajectory is. And so we asked people this, and we gave them a ton of variables they could answer. Was it affordability? Was it a loss of a job? Was it a health crisis? Was there an experience of violence? And the top reason that people reported was they lost their housing because of a breakup.
That's Caitlin Chuan, a research advisor for the Women's National Housing and Homelessness Network, a collective working to eliminate homelessness and housing insecurity for women, girls, and gender diverse people. And the findings from the report she's talking about reveal just how precarious gender equality still is in Canada.
So that outpaced affordability, loss of job, eviction, everything. This was the top reason across the country for women and for gender diverse people. It was actually higher for gender diverse folks. And so what that means from our perspective is kind of in order to remain housed, many women and gender diverse folks have to remain in a romantic or sexual relationship of some kind.
Housing is a beast of a topic. It's clear that our housing system is highly dysfunctional. People who own their primary residence account for 90% of the wealth in Canada. Meanwhile, renters as a group spend more than they earn. Since 2000, home prices have surged by over 300%, pushing rents higher as well. Meanwhile, since 1977, homeowners have accumulated $3.2 trillion in tax-sheltered wealth. No, I didn't stutter. $3 trillion. Governments have embraced the idea that the primary function of housing is as an investment to build wealth, rather than a place to live and call home. As a result, housing has shifted from being a shelter for people to a tax shelter for money. No matter how much you hear people gripe about their property taxes. This approach has pushed the cost of living beyond reach for countless Canadians whose incomes are taxed more heavily than the wealth generated by rising property values. This is called the financialization of housing, which we'll talk more about in a bit. The skyrocketing cost of housing has led Canada to have the highest household debt among G7 nations, driven by large mortgages and rising rents. This has especially affected younger and working-age Canadians whose debt-to-income ratios have hit record highs. A 2023 Angus Reid poll found that 40% of Canadians are using their savings to cover living costs. In most urban areas, the rental wage for a two-bedroom is more than twice the provincial minimum wage. In Toronto, where I live, the average rent for a two-bedroom apartment as of June 2025 is just under $3,000 a month, according to rentals.ca. It's a living nightmare. It's why Canada is earning a reputation for being impossibly unaffordable. There are many ways to approach the issue of housing, but today we'll examine it through a human rights lens, which includes economic and class analysis. Before diving into that, however, we'll begin by looking at gender.
Currently, I live in a bachelor apartment, and even to this day, I imagine what this essentially bedroom would look like with a crib in it. It just wouldn't work. Unaffordable housing scares me because I think if I were to lose the space that I'm in now, or I don't know, something happened where I had to leave, or I would be screwed.
Homelessness amongst women and gender diverse people is significantly understudied and under-researched, despite the fact that women, girls, and gender diverse people are disproportionately employed in temporary jobs, earn lower wages, and face higher levels of poverty when compared with men and boys. The traditional definitions and measurements of homelessness often fail to capture the specific ways women, girls, and gender diverse people experience housing instability. For example, violence in the home, whether from an intimate partner or from a family member, is a key pathway into homelessness for women and girls. 90% of families using emergency shelters are headed by single women, many of whom are escaping some form of violence.
When I was doing my PhD, my sister experienced a lot of intimate partner violence, and I kind of came to understand just how deeply gendered housing is and experiences of homelessness and housing precarity and violence and how entwined those are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how did your organization come to be?
Yeah, the Women's National Housing and Homelessness Network was kind of born out of a real understanding that we've built the homelessness sector really around a really male-centric model. When you think about the cultural kind of imagination around homelessness, it's often a single man outside on a street corner. So it started in the grassroots with folks experiencing homelessness and housing need and really feeling like there's huge gaps. So what we do know is that kind of based on national data, 68% of shelter beds are for men. So they're either dedicated for men or for co-ed. And 13% are for women identified folks. And then of course there's not of course, but of course, because there's systemic transphobia and kind of gender-based discrimination, very, very, very few shelters for trans and non-binary folks.
For women and gender diverse people, homelessness often looks different from men's. It may involve couch surfing, trading sex for shelter, or living in overcrowded apartments. Precarious and dangerous forms of housing that don't technically count as homelessness.
So again, one of the things, because we've built not just a homelessness sector and system, but also ways of thinking about homelessness and then ways of measuring and defining it with a really male-centric lens, we've historically really missed women and gender diverse folks' experiences of homelessness. And so we have these just huge data gaps. And a big piece of that is because we know that women and gender diverse folks experience really profound violence, systemic violence and interpersonal violence on the streets. And so they're much more likely to be in situations of what we call hidden homelessness. So whether that's couch surfing, trying to remain with friends or family as long as you possibly can, remaining in an abusive situation, because what we hear from folks across the country is they prefer to They're forced to choose between experiencing violence from one man versus many men if they're on the street. You know, folks aren't showing up at shelter doors because they can't get access. And so the assumption is there's no one there. But in fact, we have huge numbers of folks who are remaining in abusive situations, for example. And that's not, in our current definition and understanding of homelessness, that's not understood as homelessness. So those folks aren't being put on priority lists necessarily, because chronic homelessness is a priority for the government of Canada. And that really means 6 months or more experiencing unsheltered homelessness or being in a shelter. And we know lots of women, for example, with children aren't able to leave abusive situations, but they can't get on these priority lists because they don't count as experiencing chronic homelessness.
Which is to say that women, especially those who are mothers, often endure the violence they face at home to avoid the unknown dangers of life on the streets. Yet even when they make the difficult decision to leave, finding emergency shelter is far from straightforward, as one of our abortion storytellers has directly experienced.
My daughter and I were homeless for about a week. My therapist was like, you need to call some shelters. Like, you're going to have to call some shelters. And I was calling and everybody was booked. Nobody had any space. Nobody had any space. I'm so grateful. I had a professor who is amazing. She set me up with an Airbnb for a few nights.
When I reached out and was like, hey, do you want to talk about housing on an abortion podcast? Did that make sense? Like, as a researcher, what do you see as the relationship between housing and reproductive justice and how affordable housing, or the lack thereof, shapes people's reproductive choices and lives?
This is such a brilliant question.
Rachel Cairns' Abortion. Find new episodes at abortion.com, at harbingermedianetwork.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. You've been listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local community radio station. This episode has been brought to you by Unrigged. Learn more about Canada's coalition of 31 progressive publishers and get all your progressive news, videos, and podcasts in one place at unrigged.ca. And by The Alberta Advantage. Find the show's almost 9 years of archived episodes at albertaadvantagepod.com, at harbingermedianetwork.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at Harbinger Tweets and on Instagram at Media Harbinger and now Blue Sky for updates on new episodes. And subscribe to the Harbinger newsletter for a weekly Wednesday roundup from Canada's cross-country community of 83 socially and politically progressive podcasts. We're taking the rest of the summer off, but we'll be back in early September with a new episode. Until then, I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Now back to your regularly scheduled community radio station programming.
Listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.
This is Bird Note. The Florida Keys extend from the state's peninsula like a string of pearls. And pearls they are, in their uniqueness and value. Stands of hardwood trees originating in the West Indies rise above the island's level ground. These trees draw many birds of the Caribbean to the Keys tropical habitat. Listening on Key West to mangrove cuckoos and gray kingbirds, you might imagine yourself in Cuba or the Bahamas, and you might see another Caribbean bird, the white-crowned pigeon. The adult has a brilliant white crown and white iris. It sounds a lot like a mourning dove. It's a fruit eater that includes native figs and the fruit of the poisonwood tree in its diet. Like pigeons the world over, white crowns play an important role in spreading seeds. The birds swallow fruits and deposit some of the seeds on the hardwood knolls, also called hammocks. Without the pigeons, there might be no tropical hardwood hammocks in the Keys. But without the hammocks, there would be no white-crowned pigeons in Florida. If you're curious about the unique habitats of the Florida Keys and what can be done to protect them, check out the link on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.